Welcome, pudding people, to another episode of Everybody Loves Pudding. We are your hosts, Kent Seymour, Richard Geiger. Only mildly anemic in these times of superheroic salvation.
Yes, there's just a thirst for iron, for blood.
I know. These jokes are a little thin, but soon enough, you will say thanks for all of the humor that... All right, maybe not.
Sun rises, all of the bad will disappear.
That's right. I was trying to push too far. I was trying to stretch that pun out too much. It's terrible. But as you clearly know from clicking on this particular episode, we're going to be talking about Marvel's newest comic book crossover. They on occasion, Marvel and DC, they love to do these big events where there's this giant crossover. We've, in our multiple years of doing this show, we've never talked really about any of them.
No, and I'll be honest, I don't collect. You do. Mm-hmm. So you would see all those titles. You'd see the artwork. You'd see the stories. You'd see all the intricacies. I think the only one that I collected back in my day, and I bet there's millions of them out there, is when X-Force, X-Factor, X-Men did a crossover in the 90s.
The Executioner song.
Yes, that's the one. And they came with like a little trading card inside sealed up package. Yep.
Still have a few of those. Yes, good memories. Well, I figured now was a good time because I feel like this is one of those crossovers that, first of all, isn't as, you know, huge and all-encompassing as a lot of crossovers can be. But also it kind of is rooted in something that we're both kind of interested in to begin with. And, you know, we've talked about like the Blade movie many, many, many times and its sequels and whether how much we like or dislike them. But, you know, talking about vampires on its own is fun, but vampires in comics, man.
Well, I think it's there's so many other things going on when you see them in theaters or on screen in cartoon form, because I think you see more of that in cartoons, but the vampire piece of it has its own lore, and you think of that maybe vampire and Frankenstein and mummies, and they actually have that own section within Marvel and DC, for that matter.
That is true.
But when those we might actually see some of that on the DC side coming up here soon. I just feel like it's an undertouched, it's an underutilized portion. And it's easy to say, hey, Dracula is the bad vampire guy. Well, that's true, but there's just more to it than that, I feel like. Well, and yeah, they talk about the magic things, they talk about science things, and this is kind of one of those in-betweens.
Oh, well, very, very much so. Well, it's mostly magic. it's mostly magic, at least in the comics. When they introduced it into the film, they tried to make it more science-y.
Science it up, yeah.
Because, you know, that's what, at that point in time, that audiences would, I think they knew rightly, they would respond to. Especially if it's going to be based on a comic book property. They're already taking a bit of a stretch trying to get the public to accept not a top-tier character, not a second-tier character. I would argue at that point, not even a third-tier character. I mean, this is like deep cuts when they release that film, even though it's one of my favorite characters in the comics to begin with, because he's so interesting and so flawed. it's just a lot of fun to read.
Well, and there was this magical window that was much later than Blade, but also was, what, 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
Yeah, more like
when
15.
Vampires were like the hot thing. Yeah. And we saw all types of movies, TV show, like everything surrounding vampires, but nothing comic book related in print, and not in print media, but like in visual media.
Not that a lot of people would recognize. Now, now, for you dear listeners, I want you to enjoy the fact that this particular episode has no video component. If it had a video component, you would see that Richard's studio just went dark.
It's awesome. Well, we're talking about vampires, so it was perfect. It just like we were talking about it, and it just all faded away.
Oh,
it's great.
Man.
I might have forgotten to turn on a light, and then there was another one that was on that had a timer on it. Yeah. Anyway.
It's a joyous thing, and it just makes me giggle to be a part of this and to experience it. I know it's got to be exciting for you too, Richard.
Well, so here's the thing, and little backstory here, very minor. I read a book once, The End. So when it comes to reading, that's not my bag. I my brain and my attention span don't allow me to read print media. So we're talking magazines, news articles, books, short stories. It's hard for me, attention span wise, to drag those things out. I did recently read a book. It was the one the Pacific was based off of. So definitely World War II. Very good. One of the best military books ever written, honestly. And for some reason I got into it. I read it. Cool. But what you find with the comic books is that's good for short attention span, mm-hmm. right? Because you can churn through them in 5 to 10 minutes and then go back through later and appreciate all the detail that you see in the artistry in it.
Well, the other nice thing is much like movies and books, the comic books, once you've gone through them the first time, you go through again and you look like we talk about talking, watching films, looking not where you're supposed to be looking, but looking in other places, trying mm-hmm. to see what else is happening. And that is just so rewarding with comic books, being able to just be able to tear apart the little bits of art that they give and just really enjoy them in their small pieces. Now, one of the things that I wanted to kind of talk about with this, this whole crossover being vampire based, well, Marvel's been doing the vampire thing for a long time. For those of you listeners that were not aware, before Marvel was Marvel, it was Timely Comics, but not too long after the switch to Marvel in the early 40s was the first time they decided to try and use a little bit of comic books in their stories. But where it really took off was, I felt, in the 70s. You got a long run, about 70 issues of a comic called Tomb of Dracula. And that's actually where Blade got introduced as a character fairly early on. And it's in its 70s, so it's got that really fun, cheesy 70s vibe. When Blade came out, don't think Wesley Snipes. Dude had a fro, and because it's 70s, so we're thinking thinking that kind of time frame for what was considered to be cool looking. So it was completely different.
Well, it would be the same. Wasn't Power Man,
right?
In that same vein in terms of how he looked and what his clothing design was.
Absolutely, absolutely the same thing. So. You would get to see, Dracula fight the Helsings, but also Blade and a bunch of other people. And, it has been intermittent throughout the years. I know when I was really enjoying collecting comic books, there was a series called The Midnight Suns that they did, that it was just all of the really kind of mystical-based stuff. So you would have Blade teamed up with Whistler and a vampire named Hannibal King, and they hunted the supernatural baddies. And Morbius the Living Vampire had his own comic at that point, and that was one of them. And Ghost Rider and Johnny Blaze, Spirits of Vengeance was one of them, and Darkhold Redeemers. And so it just had this really, really fun boom for the supernatural element comics that happened at that time, and they've kind of not been on the same level of popularity since then, But, you know, every so often we'll get just a little bit of taste of what was there. But Blade, out of all of them, has probably maintained the most popularity.
Well, here's another thought, too. These comic books traditionally were geared towards a certain range of age groups. And now that age group, I think, has expanded even more. So when you would see comics, a lot of them you'd probably say were PG, right?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Blade is the movie, not PG. And when you see this set of comics, it's not PG, right?
Well, so there is a PG version.
That's true. which we actually chatted about, that there is actually two separate print versions of these that you can get for the younger audience. But would you say, in looking at the set of comics, because this crossover, you know, where the few that I got to take a look at were, you know, there was a lot of Avengers weight, but there's Fantastic Four and there's Spider-Man, there's all these.
Yep.
Do you think that the core audience for this is the core audience that collected comics in the 90s and now they're older? And
I'm wondering if that's the case. I'm hoping that what it is it's not so much that as the current people that are in charge looking for something that feels different from the last 10, 20 years of crossovers, of stories, and then just remembering that they have this really rich and deep history with this particular supernatural creature. They've been building on this a little bit in the background for the last couple of years. I mean, Dracula has his own nation state basically now, and that's part of the lore that's going on with you know, the build up to this event. So I feel like they go, hey, you know, we've kind of neglected the supernatural element. Why not come back to it a little bit?
But did you also see in the runs of comics over the years, you know, people's faces getting ripped off, people's entrails getting splayed out, you know, something more, quote, graphic novel-ish, right? But in the traditional everyday print that this run is.
100%. Marvel Zombies was a huge thing, you know, about 15 years ago. And it's way gorier than this is. And it had multiple runs because it started in an Ultimate Fantastic Four run. And then it transitioned. It was so popular, it got its own book. And then it got a sequel and a sequel to the sequel and a sequel to the sequel to the sequel. And it was just all over the place. And things would pop up as crossovers to other things. So it was extraordinarily popular and way nastier than what we're getting with this.
So it showed that they could do a theme that was, quote, more adult oriented.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Not only have it look good, sound good, feel good, but be popular too.
Yeah, I've got a chunk of those. I've got a large chunk of those because, you know, we've talked about you enjoying The Walking Dead, which was a popular zombie comic that got turned into a television show. This is about that time when that was, they were all, zombies were the thing, and Marvel was not going to lose money not doing some zombie stuff.
Makes sense. You know, do the thing that makes you some bucks.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
But it's got to be a good story. It's got to be good art, or it's just going to die off quick.
And some of it was better than others. I mean, as happens with many things, it started off amazing. And then some of the later art was maybe not quite to the same level, but it, you know, that happens a lot of times, or it may just be kind of a taste thing. But that's neither here nor there. So in the Marvel universe, like we were saying, the vampires are mystically based. So in fact, you know, for all of you people that are watching the MCU films and were enjoying the revelation of what happened with Scarlet Witch in the most recent Doctor Strange film and her possession of the Darkhold and it corrupting her and all that sort of thing, well, that's where vampires came from. It's kind of rather an amusing thing. They made the very first vampire canonically in Marvel was named Varney, and he was from Atlantis, and he was a sorcerer and used the Darkhold to turn himself into a vampire, starting off the whole thing.
So they've in a sense planted the seeds, and we've seen the end credits. Well, we actually didn't see Blade. We hear the voice.
Yeah, we hear the voice.
And we assume that it's Blade. We know that it's Blade, I guess, but that's it. There was a lot that was forgotten in that movie, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. The Eternals.
Right.
Like the whole ending and the fact that there's a gigantic, you know, that creature coming out of the ocean. That's its own thing. But I think the target audience, I'll go back to that again too. If we're looking at the visual media, whether it's TV shows or whatever, you know, if it's a Disney product, it's going to be, you know, PG, as we've seen. Hopefully Deadpool will come to save the day. But right. Like this would be perfect. This would be perfect. Oh, yeah. To have a whole run of all those mystic vampire, just creepy side of things. But like, you know, don't be scared and do it as like a Fox Division property. Like this, make it R, and you know, make it entertaining, and I bet you'd have plenty of fans for it.
I think so. I mean, one of them, especially like I was talking about with the Midnight Suns, the Darkhold Redeemers, was my favorite book in that entire group, and it was just all about a group of people that were trying to track down pages of the Darkhold that had been scattered and make sure they didn't fall into the wrong hands. That's like a Monster of the Week perfect premise for a television show. In fact, I think, you know, when I was younger, they had Friday the 13th, the series, which is basically the same concept. And, you know, I'll watch that all day long, especially if it has the occasional, you know, person show up. It's like, oh, Moon Knight's in this one, or, you know, something to that effect. We get a little bit of fun guest appearance, that sort of thing. But, yeah. So, but they're going in whole hog, at least on this in the comics. They're wanting to try and bring it back. You know, back before Marvel was Marvel and back before the comics code, you could see some really gnarly stuff in comic books. They didn't pull punches, but then there was the whole moral outcry and the load of BS that surrounded that, with people just putting their business where it shouldn't be and not understanding how reality works. And so that the comic book companies wouldn't be regulated by other people, they volunteered to be regulated by themselves. And then that ushered in a very PG landscape, which is the precursor to kind of what the MCU is now. But this kind of harkens back to that original feel. What did you think with the three issues that I showed you of the main storyline, which is only going to be five issues long?
Well, the first thing that you'll notice is when you go through this, there's lots of things to notice, but one, when you open it up, there's a summary of the main characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the people that are involved, good, bad, or otherwise. And it also tells you there's lots of information about the artists, and there's a lot of artists involved in these episodes. So it's not just one artist or two. I mean, there's a lot that are lending their quality to each particular unit that you're looking through here. Mm-hmm. And I know, and maybe I could be wrong, but if you're reading Spider-Man, that's kind of one artist set, and then if you're reading Fantastic Four, that's probably another one.
More often than not,
together, like people from all different areas to create these. Like one traditionally does one group, one traditionally does one group, but then they brought all three of them, four of them together to create this.
Not normally. Normally, the way these big events run, the main book, whatever it is, will just get, they will have the idea of what artist they think fits the style for what they're going to do. So they'll get the person that they want to do the pencils. They'll get the person they think that is going to be the best inker for it. They'll get the person that does the letterbox. Usually it's, well, not usually, it's about 50-50, it feels like, that the cover artist, sometimes it's the same as the interior artist. A lot of times it's not. It's somebody that's just doing the cover art for whatever it is. And a lot of times to really, I mean, it's the cynical side of me, but to really milk out the bucks, but also to give some variety, they'll have alternate covers for these that you'll be able to get. So they'll get a bunch of different cover artists to give kind of their take on whatever it is. But as far as the interior goes, it's usually just like one set that they do.
Well, I noticed that the art, so if you as a non-comic book reader think of how a comic book is constructed, right, from an art standpoint, probably cleaner lines, mm-hmm. cleaner colors, cleaner shading, more clean formed eyes, nose, ears. That's not this art style, right?
No.
But it fits the style of the book that you're reading, right? So it's kind of more, there's a lot of darker colors. There's a lot of less clean lines. There's a lot of sharp lines, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So those are some of the things that I noticed on this, but that goes back to what you said. They know the artists in their collections that are going to fit best for the mood that they're trying to deliver. And I think that part really came across in this too, is that the mood kind of matches the artwork in it.
100%. The main artist in this is Pepe Larraz, who also does at least some of the cover artwork. And then the color is Marta Gracia. Now, if you look in the first issue, it will go over that all of the variants, you get all sorts of people doing variants. And it looks like there's at least 9 different variant covers that you can get for this. So it's kind of, that was kind of like what I was talking about, to get just different feels. And the joy of collecting is you don't know which one is going to be worth money and which one is not if you're collecting for value. But if you're like me, I'm not collecting for value. I'm collecting because I want the story and I want to enjoy it and have something that somebody else can, you know, read and enjoy down the road, that sort of a thing.
Now, would it be also, they have different covers in the Midwest, different colors in the North America compared to what they would have? Or is it just like you can get them worldwide?
You can get them worldwide. They don't do regional covers. So there's going to be the one base cover for the regular Blood Hunt, and then there's going to be the Red Band cover, and then there's going to be the alternate covers. And a lot of times the way that comic book shops order, they'll know what covers are going to become available. They're going to know the cost. They also know their customers, their regulars that come in. They know who they think is going to buy these and how many. They'll have pre-orders, but they'll also say, how many do I think I can sell on top of it? Number one issues sell big, but number twos, not so much. I mean, they will sell some, but there's that drop-off as it goes forward because you lose some of the people that are in it either because they decide they didn't like the story or they didn't like the art, or more often than not, you lose the ones that are collecting for just value and they just want the number ones. And it's like, well, that doesn't necessarily mean what you think, but yeah, so you can order. It's like, oh, you know, this artist is going to be doing a variant cover. You say, hey, that's the version that I want, and they'll order it for you.
And the other thing I noticed too was in terms of the verbiage, in terms of the bubbles, in terms of the lettering, very simple,
mm-hmm.
right? You're not talking about dialogue that's per bubble 6 sentences long, no. right? It's just very quick to the point. But, and we talked about this earlier, it's cheesily descriptive, right?
Yep.
If this person, like, it's not how you would talk human to human or person to person or whatever to whatever, but
it's expositional.
I saw you walking over there, Ken Seymour, and I enjoyed you doing that. Like, I'm not going to call you by your entire name, especially if we're on like a friendship or first name right. basis.
Right.
And that makes sense to me though. Right. Because as you're reading, you want everybody to who is involved to have some type of description without having to go into six sentence detail about what that person is.
Exactly.
So just have those like sentences that in your brain don't make sense, but on the page make absolute sense.
Yeah. You get that kind of shorthand and those kinds of ways of doing things in all sorts of media that just develop over time, because that's the best way to keep the person that's consuming it engaged in whatever it is, and not just engaged, but informed, and they know what's going on. Because if they fall out of that, if they get distracted, if they lose something, well, they're not going to finish the story. And what good is it then?
I also noticed in a couple of them, they would have the character say something, but then there'd be a letterbox kind of reference to what exactly they were referencing. So yes. As a collector or something, you can go reference that particular episode. So I did appreciate that.
That is a time-honored tradition, been happening for as long as I can remember comics.
I also like, so you have your heavy hitters across this, because it's, you know, the three episodes were more Avengers based with a couple of folks in it. But I like the fact that they do have a couple of folks that show up that aren't really the quote normal ones that you are going to see plastered across a bunch of episodes. I like seeing random faces mm-hmm. and having to ask who actually is that person, so that you can tell me the description of who that person is. So that's very good. I've said before, there's on Max, you could watch Young Justice, and it's mm-hmm. just about a whole bunch of, you know, like Justice League offshoot stuff, and all the randos that show up in there make it more enjoyable to pull up your phone and like, 'cause I don't know who that person is. Let's see some history on it. So even if the show doesn't actually match the storybooks and the comics, it interests me to right. see who this person actually is in print and what their story is. But this is the same way too. So I appreciate them having variety, if you will, on this.
Definitely.
And then the collection of bad guys that are in here. Tell me about those guys. Is this new to this story, or is that they have some history?
This is where we're going to venture into a little bit of spoiler territory. So if you think you want to read Bloodhunt, and you don't want to be spoiled on anything, this is the point to jump off the episode and then come back later. But we're in the middle of it. They're only to the third issue of the 5-issue miniseries. And while there are a lot of tie-ins, you don't have to read all of them to know what's going on, though it helps to get the bits and pieces here and there. So your question was some of the non-Avengers characters that are the bad guys that are involved. So obviously we've got the big reveal at the end of the first episode is that the person behind all of the things that are happening, the big bad stuff, it's Blade for some reason. Except probably not.
It's probably not, no.
But so he has put together his own group of people because he needed to be able to take on the Avengers. Now, this is the thing that really makes me laugh a little bit. So vampires, stronger than humans, sure. But in terms of major bad guys that are going to cause a big problem, normally not so much. I mean, most superhero groups will absolutely wipe the floor with any vampire at any time. Even if you get a bunch of them, you can get a couple hundred. And, you know, like the Fantastic Four, that couple of hundred, it'll take them maybe 5 minutes and they'll be done with it. Or the Avengers, if you get them together, give them a couple thousand. Same thing, about 5 minutes and they'll be done with them. So they had to find a way to make them a real threat. And the combination of the surprise attack from somebody that's supposed to be an ally, along with, oh, we've been having them feed on superhuman blood. These are brand new characters. None of these are really, with the exception of one of them, has had a little bit of history, but not much. But they're all basically new creations that are specifically there to cause problems for the Avengers for a short period of time. So they're kind of disposable in that sense. But still, the designs on them, super cool.
And what's the okay? So we know in the Justice League there's the orbital satellite, if you will, floating around Earth that Batman has funded and paid for, and that's where you meet. So what's this thing floating around Earth in Marvel universe?
Now, if I remember correctly, it is some celestial technology. That's the Impossible City is what it's called. So. This is a newer thing that happened because, you know, for the longest time, the Avengers were basically based out of a mansion. You know, it was kind of a weird thing, but, you know, it worked for the time that it was. And you could always have the high-tech stuff on the underneath. It was kind of like the Xavier's kind of school for gifted for gifted youngsters. They hid the stuff away from where everyone else could see it, sort of a thing. But as things went, they wanted it to be a little bit more cooler. And at one point they decided that what they were going to do was they were going to have, like, they're going to live in a portion of a celestial. So, now the Impossible City for Marvel, that's a little bit different. I'm not 100% sure. I've fallen off a little bit from exactly what it is. I don't know if this is still that celestial technology. This could be something that is a little bit different, something to do with the Beyonders. But it basically is semi-sentient. And they can kind of get it to transport them around and kind of do whatever they need it to do. So that's kind of what I know about it.
Yeah, it seemed kind of not necessarily automated, but it seemed like they were communicating directly to it in a certain sense.
Yeah. So
except it had been infiltrated and had been overcome, it had been overtaken almost completely, but just enough for the heroes to escape some of them.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of the standard stuff. It's a lot of plot hammer kind of things, but I have to admit I am not as versed on that.
Got him.
Yeah, it happens, but there's so many comics at any given time.
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, if you look at the checklist for this, so at the end of the comic, there's a checklist for you to collect all the particular episodes that revolve around this crossover. And you said you'd counted them yourself. There's like 50,
mm-hmm.
But it's all different subsets, right? So it's just. So many different characters, so many different stories, so many different storylines that's hard to kind of keep track of all those. And then their history that they've had for 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
So apparently it was a sentient headquarters for a group of unknown heroes who defeated and imprisoned a group called the Ashen Combine, who are a bunch of nasty, very powerful, dimension-hopping, multiversal bad guys that ended up showing up in Earth 616, and then the Avengers beat them and took their base. Your base are belong to us.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So that's what that is. I'm sure they will reveal other cool things about it as they go. They that's always a good thing to do. It's like, well, it's not from this universe, so we can kind of just make stuff up as we want.
Tell them stories. Yep. That's when they're, well, if it's 616, and I mean, there's how many different, you know, variants of Earth?
Right.
Endless. So you could always make up, this is from Earth 728549.
Yeah.
And that's just the way you keep things fresh. We're seeing that now in the TV shows and in the movies too. So it's when you've had the print media for these stories for what, 70 years, it's mm-hmm. it's hard to keep people alive or stories fresh or people young, right? They
right.
tend to stay the same age. So
Well, the thing that really gets me about this particular storyline is they are doing some deep cuts from some of the original stories. They're pulling in characters that I haven't heard from in forever, like for the Avengers part of it, and in the main Avengers story, they're dealing with Baron Blood, who's like a Nazi vampire. But it's like we haven't seen Baron Blood since. Well, like since the early 80s is the last time I remember seeing him. And there's a lot of these characters that we just haven't seen in a long time. And they're bringing them all in or referencing other things that were really cool. I know you've been an X-Men person. There's a one-off they did that was Jubilee dealing with this whole thing. Well, in the comics, Jubilee was a vampire for a while.
And now...
Well, she got better. it's comics.
Yeah, so Marvel's got a cure for it then?
There are always ways around it. The biggest cure is the Montesi formula that's part of the whole Darkhold thing. But there are always ways to kind of, you know, bend reality and do whatever it is that you're trying to do to make whatever you want to happen. But supposedly there's going to be some big shift that's going to happen at the end of this crossover that's going to have lasting effects. We'll see if that's actually true or if that's just hyperbole. I would like to think that there's going to be some fun stuff that's going to come out of this, but we'll find out. The story has been really fun so far. Even all of the different little side stuff that's been going on. You get to, like I said, a bunch of those one-offs. There's a short series called Blood Hunters. They're just short stories about other characters and what they're doing while this is happening. So you get a story that's based around Hawkeye. You get a story that's based around some of the other people that are just dealing with stuff. And it's like Hulk, I think, is one of them that they do. And so it's just, you know, it's really kind of nice. They show what everyone is doing, even if they're not involved in the main storyline, because this is a worldwide thing that's happened. They blotted out the sun. So it's, you know, nobody's safe from this stuff.
Yep. Blotted out the sun. And all of a sudden the bad guys are attacking.
Yeah.
But Dracula doesn't like it because it's his world too.
That's right.
Right.
Well, he likes, so it's, he knows he's finally in a place where he can scheme and do what he needs to do, and he's actually somewhat insulated for once. He's got some defenses, so he doesn't have to worry about vampire hunters constantly coming after him.
Yeah, it's good so far, and the, like I said, the artwork's great, and seeing other characters pop up and seeing faces and seeing the verbiage and how the characters are drawn now compared to what, you know, they stick, how your image of them might be in your head. So there's a lot of good variety that comes about reading some of these things.
Yes, there definitely is. There's all sorts of good stuff to be had in the main units and the main plot and everything that goes along with it. But, you know, let us know what you think. Let us know who you think is behind everything. This is the very last little tidbit that I'm going to reveal who I think is behind everything. And it's somebody that I already mentioned in this episode. I think it's Varney, who in the comics, they based him off of kind of a pulp character, Varney the Vampire. Just don't ask. but we haven't seen him since like 1993. And the last time that we saw him, you know what he wanted to do? Take over Blade's body. He was unsuccessful. He had to go with somebody else called the Night Terror. And we haven't heard from him since then either. But, you know, my theory is maybe that didn't go so well. And or he was able to find a way to be able to transmute and finally take over Blade the way that he wanted to. I'm betting it's him because he was the first vampire, and they've already talked about Atlantis, and whoever's in charge of this knows about all this stuff. And Blade, as good as he is, doesn't know about all this stuff. So I'm guessing it's him.
be a good reveal. And like you said, lots of throwbacks. So it makes sense.
Yeah. But next week, this has kind of inspired us. You know, Marvel villains are fun. And we've already talked about DC villains. So why don't we do a top 10 Marvel villains, in our opinion, of all time?
Except you can't have Thanos.
I haven't decided whether I'm going to include him or not. Because I like him so much.
So much.
Join us next week, and you will find out who we think are the most entertaining, because that's really what this list is. It's not about power levels. It's about who we think are the most fun to read or to watch face off against our good guys to give them a run for the money.
Who are you? Who are they going to be?
Yeah, it's hard to say. There's a guy that uses roller skates to fight Batman. Maybe it'll be him.